My dear brothers and sisters of our Lord and Savior Jesus, the topic of our discussion this afternoon is Edom, Moab, and the children of Ammon. And we will endeavor to show that the Bible prophecies concerning these Arab peoples, past and present, have come true and how they are poised to continue to do so. But first, let us define what peoples we are talking about. When in a scriptural sense we refer to the Arabs, we are referring generally to a special people who are descended from the same ancestry as were the Jews, and who inhabited the same general land, that is, the Middle East. The Bible has different terms for this general race of people. They are called Arabs, a word which means to lurk, or to lie in wait, to ambush. And this gives us the Jews' opinion of their close kinfolk and neighbors. The region which they inhabited was called Arabia from similar roots, but carrying more the impression of a desert, a dryness. Who were these people, and where did they come from? Well, as we said, the Arabs share a common ancestry with the Jews. The first ancestor of the Arabs was Lot, Abraham's nephew. Lot fathered two men who went on to become mighty. In Genesis 19, verse 36, we read, "Thus were both the daughters of Lot with child by their father, and the firstborn bare a son and called his name Moab. The same is the father of the Moabites unto this day. The younger, she also bare a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. The same is the father of the children of Ammon unto this day." Now, Ammon and Moab settled the region which today we would call the nation of Jordan, and they became the Jews' neighbors to the east. The Edomites are descendants of Esau, who was Isaac's son and Jacob's brother. His descendants became known as the Edomites. This was due to the fact that he sold his birthright for a mess of red pottage, and Edom also means red. And we read there in the next verse that Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray thee, with the same red pottage, for I am faint." Therefore, his name is called Edom. So we see that all these people are close relations to the Jewish people. And it is for that reason that we find they have a special place in Bible prophecy. And I might add that there is another significant contributor to the Arab people who also is a close relation, which is Ishmael, the son of Abraham, by Hagar. In Genesis 16:15, we read, "And Hagar bare Abram a son, and Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bare, Ishmael." But the promises were not to go through Ishmael, but through Abraham's seed through faith, through Isaac, his half-brother, and Sarah, the free woman. So Ishmael was turned out from the promises by God. In Genesis 21, though, at verse 14, we read, "And Abraham rose up early in the morning and took bread and a bottle of water and gave it unto Hagar and put it on her shoulder and the child and sent her away. And she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water was spent in a bottle, and she cast the child under one of the shrubs. And she went and sat her down against him a good way off, as it were a bowshot, for she said, Let me not see the death of the child. And she sat over against him and lift up her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said unto her, What aileth thee, Hagar? Fear not, for God hath heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him in thy hand, for I will make him a great nation." So we can see that all these people, which we call Arabs, were all closely related to the Israelites. But as God said, "Isaac have I loved, and Esau have I hated." Why? Because in Jacob have I loved, and Esau have I hated. Why? Because in the case of these brothers, they did not respect and love God in the same way. Esau took wives from the children of the land of Canaan. Lot chose to live among the immoral people of Sodom and Gomorrah, and planned to take his husbands for his daughters from the men of the town, rather than keep himself a separate and dedicated people. So the promises made to Abraham took a different direction away from them, and this made them quite envious. And it has, in both the past and the present, made them celebrate and even participate in the punishment which God has brought against Israel for their disobedience. So from the point of view when the Bible was written, the Arab nations are very close relations to the Jews, and would today consist of those modern nations of Jordan and those of the Arabian, with those of the Arabian Peninsula of Yemen, and even the southern regions south of Israel. But as we continue to define what peoples we are talking about when we say Arabs in the modern sense, we must also take into consideration the most significant event in Arabian history, which of course was the rise of Muhammad the Great in 609 AD. Muhammad was a wonderful general from Medina in Saudi Arabia who fancied himself a prophet and caused to be written the Quran or the Book of Islam. He then embarked on a military adventure and ended with the Arabian world under his control, and all of the Middle East and North Africa and Turkey and parts of Southern Europe by 900 AD. The significance of this cannot be ignored, because the Arab race turned nations which were not originally Arab into Arab states. Such nations would be Lebanon and Syria and Iraq to the north, in Egypt and Libya to the southwest. So for our purposes this afternoon, we will be discussing these Arab states. We will keep them for alliance purposes in three groups. The northern group, which is Syria, Iraq, and their ally in Libya. The southern group, which is Lebanon and Jordan and Yemen and Egypt. And the Arabian group, which is Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, and Kuwait. And as an aside, let me interject something here about the religion of Islam, which confuses many people. All the Arabs are Islamic states, but not all Islamic states are Arab. Iran and Turkey and Afghanistan and many of the African states, like Ethiopia, for instance, are of the same religion as the Arabs. They are Islamic, but they are not Arab. Racially and scripturally, they are different peoples. So they will generally be outside the scope of our discussion this afternoon. We're not ignoring them, for they are scripturally significant in their own right and will be covered in other talks. Now, what is the scriptural position of the Arabs in Bible prophecy? It can be fairly summed up in two simple principles. The Jews as a race are God's chosen people. The Arabs are a race are second behind the Jews, and that is the first point. The second is this. When Israel was obedient to God and followed the commands that he had placed before them, Israel dominated her Arab neighbors. But when Israel rebelled against God, her neighbors, those Arabs, Edom, Moab, the children of Ammon, with the others in the region, rose against Israel with God's help and direction, and brought punishments upon Israel because of her iniquity. It is upon these two principles that we can understand the position of the Arab in Bible prophecy. Now, when we say that Israel is God's first love and the Arabs his second, we must be clear that there is a huge difference between the first and the second. Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated, is the way the Apostle Paul put God's relationship between Israel and our Arab neighbors. But the word translated hate there carries the implication of simply loving less. The Jews' brothers, the Arabs, are not a forgotten people in the eyes of God, though the Arabs do not know God. The time is yet ahead when the prophecy of Isaiah shall come to be, as he said in Isaiah 19, verse 24, In that day shall Israel be a third with Egypt and with Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, mine inheritance. As we said, the Arabs were also used in the scriptures as the tool in the hand of God to give Israel a barometer as to their obedience. When the Jews were obedient, such as under the rule of David, the Arabs paid tribute to Israel. But when they rebelled against God, God set Arabs up over Israel. Thus we see Jesus being born into the rebellious Israel who was under the control of Herod the Idumean. Now, Idumean is simply the Greek name for Edomite. Esau ruled Jacob when Herod governed Israel. And this, of course, was a very wicked time for Israel, the time in which the Jews crucified their Savior and King, Jesus the Christ. But along with being punished, being a punishing sword for Israel in a rebellion, God has also used these Arabs to punish the true and most significant enemy of Israel, the Catholic Church. This was the work of Muhammad, and we are still seeing the ramifications of that work today in what used to be Yugoslavia. There we see three sworn enemies, the Greek Orthodox Serbs, the Roman Catholic Croats, and the Muslim Bosnians, all at each other's throats. They have been bitter enemies since the Muslims first made inroads into the southern Europe, persecuting all who worship the Trinity. And the Pope himself just recently realized how deep that hatred is when he made remarks concerning the Muslims in Germany, and that this past week has resulted in calls for his death throughout the Muslim world. This was the Bible's prophecy of what was to happen in that reading which we read at the start of this discussion in Revelations 9, verses 1 through 12. And so we won't read that all again now. I mean, we haven't time this afternoon to give a full explanation of the meaning of this prophecy, but let's simply say that the star falling from the heaven there refers to the stunning and brilliant rise of Muhammad onto the world scene. He was a brilliant light into the world's heavens or political arena. And he arose from the land of the children of Moab and Ammon, more properly translated an abyss or a deep spot. And this is the region from which the Arabs spring. It is so called because the Dead Sea is the lowest spot on the face of the inhabited earth, being over 1,300 feet below sea level. Now the armies which spring forth from this land of Moab and Edom are called a smoking furnace or locust. Why were the armies of Muhammad symbolized by locusts? First, Arabia is the native country of the locusts, so armies issuing from Arabia would fitly be styled the locusts. And second, the Hebrew word for locust, when spelled out, is the same word for Arab. The vowel points when added slightly change the word, but locust in Hebrew is arbeth, and Arab is arbai. Third, parts of the Arabian literature introduced the locust as the heraldic symbol of the Saracens. And fourth, the Muslims believe that the source of their revelation in the Quran, the locust dropped into the hands of Muhammad, bearing these inscriptions on their wings, which describe Muhammad's armies as the army of the great God. So they had a lot of things in common with this description or the symbol of the locust. Now the destruction which was to fall on the world by this shooting star and its armies was not to be indiscriminate, but highly specific. It was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. The command to the Mohammedan locusts to confine their depredations within certain specific rules was well marked in the form it actually took. In an address given to the Saracen troops after Muhammad's death by Abu Bakr, Muhammad's successor, gave his purpose to prosecute the war against specifically the Roman Catholics, who he called infidels. He said, quoting now from Abu Bakr, Let not your victory be stained with the blood of women or children. Destroy no palm trees, nor burn any fields of corn. Cut down no fruit trees, nor do any mischief to cattle. You will find another sort of people that belong to the synagogue of Satan, who have shaven crowns. Be sure you cleave their skulls and give them no quarter till they either turn Mohammedan or pay tribute. And so and in further descriptions there from Revelations 9, the locust carried a weapon which stung as a scorpion. This is another unique feature of the Arab invasions. The Arabs carried what probably was the first effective artillery divisions in the world's history. They were great missiles previously unknown to the world's warfare. But because of their size and crude methods for transporting them, they were always the last part of the military expedition. Hence, like the scorpion, the sting of these clouds of locusts was in their tail. The Muslims themselves even referred to these weapons as scorpions. An Arab writer in 1249 writes thus, "The scorpions, surrounded and lighted by nitrated powder, glide along like serpents with a humming noise, and when exploded, they blaze brightly and burn. Now to behold the matter expelled was a cloud extended through the air, which gave forth a dreadful crash like thunder, vomiting fire on every side and breaking down, burning and reducing all things to ashes." Also, identifying the Arabs with this prophecy was the Saracen troop himself. History tells us that he wore a yellow turban, a beard, and had uncut hair. The prophecy said he wore a crown of gold and had a face of a man and the hair of a woman. So God was using the Arabs as one of his tools and using him to persecute the Catholic Church. How did it come to pass that the Arabs developed such a hatred for the Catholics? It comes directly from the Quran. In the section of the Quran called the Table, we find this written, starting from there, verse 76. "They are unbelievers," it says in the Quran, "who say God is the Messiah, Mary's son. For the Messiah said, 'Children of Israel, serve God, my Lord, and your Lord. Verily, whoso associates God with anything, God shall prohibit him entrance to paradise, and his refuge shall be the fire. And wrongdoers shall have no helpers.' They are unbelievers who say, 'God is the third of three. There is no God but one God.' If they refrain not from what they say, there shall afflict those of them that disbelieve a painful chastisement. Will they not turn to God and pray his forgiveness? God is all forgiving, all compassionate. The Messiah, son of Mary, was only a messenger. Messengers before him passed away. His mother was just a woman. They both ate food. Behold how we made clear the signs to them, and then behold how perverted they are." In this portion of the Quran, Muhammad is clearly teaching against the Trinity. He really disliked the belief that Jesus was a God, and he disliked it so much that he deals with this subject over and over again. At another point in the Quran, God and Jesus are said to have this discussion in a book called The Table at verse 115. "And when God said, 'O Jesus, son of Mary, didn't thou say unto men, take me and my mother as gods apart from God? And he, that is Jesus, said, to thee be glory. It is not mine to say what I have no right to. If indeed I said it, thou knowest it, knowing what is within my soul. And I know not what is within thy soul. Thou knowest the things unseen. I only said to them what thou didst command me. Serve God, my Lord, and your Lord." Every time Jesus is referred to in the Quran, and he's referred to another 93 different times, it is always in some way, directly or indirectly, set apart from the Trinity. Even in the story of Jesus' virgin birth, which is taught in the Quran, Muhammad concludes this in the house of Imran, verse 56. "Say, people of the book, come now to a work common between us and you, that we serve none but God, and that we associate nothing with him. But do not take some others as lords apart from God. And if they turn their backs, say, 'Bear witness that we are Muslims.'" When the Muslims say, we associate nothing with God, they mean that they do not associate Jesus as an associate with God or as a co-God. So this anti-Trinitarian flavor is found throughout the Quran, and it led to a hatred and a common battle cry for the destruction of Roman Catholicism and those who deified Jesus and his mother, Mary. So clearly, God used the Arab to do his bidding in punishing the enemies of God's people. And so he will again. Now let's stop at this point and focus our attention not on what God has done in the past with the Arabs, but what the future lies before for them. As Christadelphians, we believe that Jesus will return to the earth and again set up the kingdom of Israel on the mountains of Israel. The Arabs will be both a help and a hindrance in the work of Jesus. Remember the three groups we earlier divided the Arabs up into: the northern group of Syria and Iraq, and the southern group of Egypt, Lebanon, and Jordan, and the Arabian group of those states of the Arabian Peninsula. These groups are the Bible's divisions to the events of the latter day. And at the latter day, two great powers will be pitched against each other in a great battle for control of the wealth in the Middle East. And that wealth, of course, means oil. The two powers are Russia, leading a northern confederacy, which includes all of continental Europe, and the northern Islamic states like Turkey and Iran and Iraq and Syria. And the southern power, which is the Britain and the United States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand and India. And those southern states of Egypt, Jordan, which is Moab and Edom, Lebanon, and the western portions of Saudi Arabia. While these two mighty nations vie for economic control of the world, a third power arises in their midst. Jesus, the Son of God, returns to the earth in the deserts of Sinai, in the land of Edom, for the purpose of the judgment of the quick and the dead, to determine who is worthy to proceed with him to establish God's glory throughout all the earth. As Jesus himself prophesied, his kingdom will start out very small, like the seed of a mustard seed tree, but grow into a giant, huge tree. The Arabs of the desert, those of the Arabian Peninsula, will become Jesus' tool as part of the growth of that mustard seed. The prophet Habakkuk wrote in Habakkuk 3 at verse 3, God came from Teman, which is in Edom, and the Holy One from Mount Parah, which is in Edom. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise, and his brightness was as the light. He had horns coming out of his hands, and there was the hiding of his power. Before him went the pestilence, and burning coals went forth at his feet. He stood and measured the earth. He beheld and drove asunder the nations, and the everlasting mountains were scattered. The perpetual hills did bow. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Now this song in Habakkuk is sometimes compared to the song of Moses because the way it's translated has led people to believe that this is the song that Moses sung when he entered into the Holy Land. And certainly there are similarities. But it is not the song of Moses. For this in Habakkuk is a prophecy, not a history. Instead of saying, God came in from Teman, it should be translated, El shall come in from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. You see, it's talking about a future event, not a past history. The confusion comes from the fact that when Jesus leads his army into the Holy Land, he will do so following the same path as Moses took when he came up out of Egypt, compassing the land of Edom and Moab and the children of Ammon. Now the prophets say that he saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains in the land of Midian did tremble. The Midianites, as we have already shown, were the inhabitants of the Arabian Peninsula. Cushan is the ancient area of the Garden of Eden. It is the northern tip of the Persian Gulf. So when the prophet sees the Holy One coming in from Teman, literally from the south, he already sees the Arabian Peninsula in subjection to this Holy One. This agrees with and explains many of the testimonies of the latter days. While the great powers of the world, Russia and the United States and Britain with their allies, all of them play out their role, Christ and the saints occupy their time with the Arabian Peninsula and those member states there. In Isaiah 43 at verse 18, we learn what will be done. Remember ye not the former things, neither consider the things of old. Behold, I will do a new thing. Now it shall spring forth. Shall ye not know it? I will even make a way in the wilderness and rivers in the desert. The beasts of the field shall honor me, the dragons and the owls, because I give waters in the wilderness and the rivers in the desert to give drink to my people, my chosen. This people have I formed for myself. They shall show forth my praise. But thou hast not called upon me, O Jacob, though thou hast been weary of me, O Israel. Now, in order for Jesus to make a way in the wilderness and create rivers in the desert, and for the beasts of the desert, which is a symbolical reference to the Arabs inhabiting that region, in order for them to be honored and to honor the chosen one, which is Christ, they must first come under his control. And again, of this time, Isaiah prophesied in Isaiah 35 and verse 1, the wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. And again, in Isaiah 41 and verse 18, we read, I will open rivers in high places and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water, and the dry land springs of water. I will plant in the wilderness the cedar, the shittah tree, and the myrtle, and the oil tree. And I will set in the desert the fir tree, and the pine, and the box tree together, that they may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of the Lord hath done this, and the Holy One of Israel hath created it. And finally, for now, in Isaiah 42 at verse 11, let the wilderness and the cities thereof lift up their voice, the villages that Kedar doth inhabit. Let the inhabitants of the rock sing. Let them shout from the top of the mountains. Let them give glory unto the Lord and declare his praise in the islands. The Lord shall go forth as a mighty man. He shall stir up jealousy like a man of war. He shall cry, yea, roar. He shall prevail against his enemies. Now it must be evident that before the dwellers of the deserts and rocks and in the wilderness can give glory to God, they must themselves first be subject to the conquering force of Jesus and the saints. So prior to involving himself as a mighty man in the battles taking place between those northern and southern powers, Jesus conquers the Arabian Peninsula for himself, rallying the Arabs to obey him and become a part of his army who will conquer the world. But John Thomas in his exposition said he will be a modern Lawrence, or Lawrence of Arabia. To this end, there is a remarkable feature in the religion of Islam. Islam teaches that Jesus was taken by God into heaven, and at the last hour, as they call it, what we would call the last days, Jesus will return to the earth to fight the Antichrist and to conquer Jerusalem. Observe this from a writing called The Criticisms of Hayden. Quoting now, the whole body of Muslims throughout the centuries have held that at the end of the age, a man of the family of the prophets must appear who will strengthen religion and make justice manifest. The Muslims will follow him, and he will gain possession of the Muslim kingdoms and be called Al-Mahdi. Al-Dajjal, the Antichrist, will come, and afterwards the signs of the last hour indicated in the Sahih. Then Jesus will descend from heaven and kill Al-Dajjal, or as some say, will descend with him and help to kill Al-Dajjal, and will have Mahdi as imam in prayer. And again, from the same book, we read from the Criticisms of Hadith, the Al-Kalam assert that two following hadiths are contradictory and mutually exclusive, namely A, there will be no prophet after me and no religion after my religion. The lawful and the unlawful will be what God has permitted and forbidden according to my words until the last day. That was a saying by Muhammad. And B, The Messiah will descend and slay swine, break the cross, and add to the lawful. And from Aisha, say of the apostle of God, the seal of the prophets, do not say there will be no prophet after him. But actually, do the next. Going on with the criticism, now we maintain that there is no contradiction whatsoever in these statements, for the Messiah was an earlier prophet whom God took up to himself and will send him down again at the end of the age as a sign of the hour. As God has said, verily he shall be a sign of the hour. Now then, when we see from the Quran that the Muslims are looking for Jesus to return to the earth in the last hour, and to battle Al-Dajjal, or the Antichrist, and we know how they feel about the Pope and the papal powers, and that force which will actually come against Jesus, it is easy to see how this blends with their superstition in the Quran. Will it then seem unusual to the Arabians of the desert, when Jesus of Nazareth enters into the Arabian Peninsula and begins to conquer the Muslim kingdoms of Oman and the Emirates, and Bahrain, and Kuwait, and the eastern half of Saudi Arabia? It won't seem unusual to them at all. To many living there, it will appear to be what was prophesied in the Quran all along. And this, in this matter, isn't it interesting that the Catholic superstition says that at the time of the end, a Jew will return into the Holy Land, surrounded by Jews, and they tell their followers to oppose him with all their might. Which is exactly what the Bible says the Catholic nations will do to Jesus, and also exactly what the Muslims expect to happen. On the other hand, the Muslim superstition will tell their adherents to follow Jesus and to oppose the Pope. And it's truly marvelous how God goes about causing his plan to come to pass. But back to the Arabs. If the Arabs of the peninsula are willing to follow Jesus and the saints after he has conquered the region, why won't Arabs from all regions follow Jesus? The answer is quite simple. Just as there are many forms and different beliefs in the Christian religions, such as Catholics and Methodists and Baptists, there are just as many forms and different branches in the Muslim religions, like Baths and Sunnis and Shiites. These groups have different understandings of things in the Quran, which shape their views of its teachings and prophecies, and above all things, shapes its politics, such as we're seeing on the world stage today. There is more than enough discussion about what it is that Jesus will do to cause the religious leaders of the northern group and the southern group to oppose the position of their Arab brethren on the peninsula. For instance, we read this of one Muslim critic concerning the return of Jesus. He says, "And when the Messiah descends, he will not abrogate anything that Muhammad, the apostle of God, commanded, nor will the iman from his religion be first, but he will set Muhammad first and pray behind him." Well, when Jesus returns to the earth, that simply will not happen. Though Muhammad claimed that the Jewish Old Testament, along with the Gospel, is delivered by the apostles, were the inspired work of God, and even though Muhammad appears to have had a better understanding of those works than many of his Christian counterparts, there is still so much objectionable in his faith and writings that it can be called nothing other than a superstition. For instance, the Quran denies the sinlessness of Jesus, which is the cornerstone of all Christian belief. Now the Arabs, who align themselves with the north or the south, will find enough reasons in the Quran to oppose the power in Arabia, Christ and the saints. The Arabians in the southern group will have a much less fortunate end and future than those of Edom, Moab, and Ammon. Of this southern group, it says in Isaiah 43:3, "For I am the Lord thy God, the Holy One of Israel, thy Savior. I gave Egypt for thy ransom, Ethiopia and Sheba for thee." During the course of the war, which we typically call Armageddon, the Russians will gain the upper hand over the United States and her allies. Russia will be victorious over the southern countries, including the apple of God's eye, which is Jerusalem. In Zechariah 14, at verse 1, we read, "Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall be cut off from the city, not be cut off from the city. And though the destruction of Jerusalem is terrible, God gives Egypt to the Russians as a ransom for Israel. In other words, Jerusalem, though taken captive and subject to the devastation, that devastation is not as bad as it would otherwise have been had God not caused Russia's attention to be focused on Egypt and those Arabs of the south. In Isaiah chapter 19, verse 4, we read this, "And the Egyptians will I give over into the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them, saith the Lord of hosts. And the water shall fail from the sea, and the river shall be wasted and dried up. And they shall turn the rivers far away, and the brooks of defense shall be emptied and dried up. The reeds and the flags shall wither, the paper reeds by the brooks, by the mouth of the brooks, and everything sown by the brooks shall wither, be driven away, and be no more. The fishers also shall mourn, and all they that cast angle into the brooks shall lament. They that spread nets upon the waters shall languish. Moreover, they that work in fine flax, and they that weave network, shall be confounded, and they shall be broken in the purposes thereof, all that make sluices and ponds for fish. Surely the princes of Zoan are fools, and the counsel of the wise counselors of Pharaoh is become brutish. How say ye unto Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, the son of the ancient kings? Where are they? Where are thy wise men? Let them tell thee now, and let them know what the Lord of hosts hath purposed upon Egypt. Such is the hope for Egypt. And the northern group, they too will fall, though not at the hands of the Russians or Americans, but at the hands of Christ when he defeats Russia on the mountains of Israel, as prophesied in the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, which will be covered in other talks which we have. But the hope will be not for the nations of Moab and Edom and Ammon, for they will be destroyed before Christ in the armies of the saints, but for those people of the land of Moab and Edom and Arabia, those relatives to the Jews who submit to Jesus' righteous rule when he comes to the desert to make them blossom like a rose, these have hope for that world which will be established. Those Arabs who disdain the paths of their fathers and who reject the associations with the rest of the Arab world. We will conclude this with a final thought heavily borrowed from Brother Thomas. Writing in Eureka, Brother Thomas wrote of the conclusion of this, "The result of the reaping of the harvest and treading the winepress by Christ and the saints is the binding of the dragon power and the shutting of it up in the abyss for 1,000 years. The taking away of the dominion of the Assyrian lion, the Medo-Persian bear, and the Greco-Egyptian Anglican leopard will be for a season and a time. These organizations of people are not destroyed as was the Babylonian fourth beast embodying the Laodicean apostasy. They are conquered and deprived of dominion, which is transferred to their conquerors, the saints, who will have brought down their strength with the sanguinary and mighty overthrow. Thus Assyria and Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, and the islands of the sea will have felt the edge of the two-edged sword of the saints, as well as Europe and the West. For like birds of prey, their tribes will fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the West. They will spoil them of the East together. They will lay their power upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon will obey them. The face and the condition of the East will then be altogether changed. With the present spiritual and temporal constitution of Christendom and Mohammedism destroyed, and the East brought into subjection to deity, the nations then will be truly blessed, and with and in Abraham and his seed, as predicted in the Gospel of the Kingdom. Yahweh will be made known to Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know Yahweh in that day, and shall do sacrifice and oblation. In that day there shall be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptian shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the land, whom Yahweh Tzevaoth shall bless, saying, Blessed be Egypt my people, and Assyria the work of my hands, and Israel mine inheritance. May it be our lot, brothers and sisters, to be able to go forth with the saints in that great day, to make the desert blossom like a rose, and to see the wondrous age when Christ and the saints shall rule the earth in peace.